We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you here, and we're also glad to have here in studio with us Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We are here with him once a month, and it's a program that's all about home maintenance. Now, if you have a problem, need to fix something, you're thinking about making some changes, doing some remodeling. He knows a lot about all the various pieces and parts that go into the single-family home. So maybe you're thinking about wanting to do something to make your house more comfortable, more energy efficient, anything. Or again, if there's some problem that has come up here, give us a call, and he will do his best to help you out. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that. Will-talk is the address, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Thanks very much for being here.
Yeah, thank you, David. Good morning.
I was thinking to myself, I cannot think of another time. Now, maybe it's happened, but I can't think of any time recently when at our house we've had the air conditioning and the heat on within about a day.
Yeah, it's typical Illinois weather, big temperature swings. Yeah.
So I guess, though, that now people, probably there are a lot of people who have maybe for the first time this year, used their, if they have central air, have had it on for the very first time as we popped some days in the 80s last week. Anything, you know, general you want to say about routine maintenance for air conditioning?
Well, springtime is, of course, time when all the grass grows and the weeds grow faster. Go out the outdoor unit and look and make sure that we don't have any weeds choking off the airflow to the outdoor compressor unit. In order for it to work efficiently, it needs to get a good air supply past the air conditioning coils. So make sure things are trimmed back a couple of feet back away from the coils so that that air can move through there and we can keep that air conditioner running efficiently. Of course, it's always a good idea to change the filters in the springtime, once in the summertime, once in the fall, again in the winter. Get at least four of them in there unless you've got one of the high-efficiency filters. But, when bouncing between air conditioning and heating, a good filter to make sure we're operating efficiently, and head out there and make sure that that outdoor unit can breathe.
Yeah. That's one of the things that you want to put that in a place where it's not going to be really obvious, when it's kind of hidden from public view. And at the same time, you have to make sure that it does get plenty of room around it for air circulation around the unit.
And a lot of times when they're being hidden around a corner or something, for some reason or another, the dryer vent seems to get stuck in behind it. So if you end up running the dryer at the same time you run the air conditioner sucks up the extra lint from the dryer. So you might even look behind it and see if it looks like the fins have gotten some debris clogged in there from the dryer vent, because it's absolutely amazing how many of them are actually within a foot or two of the dryer vent coming out of the house, in which case we're going to need to turn the unit, power the unit off, take the top off of it, get a hose, and try and flush it out from the inside. Try not to soak the fan motor, but just blow things out from the backside or from the inside and try and push that the lint and dirt and debris. Also, I do recommend when cutting the grass, don't be aiming the grass clippings and cuttings back towards that air conditioner unit. We definitely don't want a rock to chip one of the tubes and have a Freon leak, but we also don't want the grass clippings blocking the cooling fins.
Okay. Got some callers. Let's go to it. Start out with someone in Atlanta. Line one. Hello.
Good morning, and thanks for the program, and thanks for taking my question to both of you. The question is, a leaky roof has caused some water stain on a raw wood pine ceiling, and I wonder if you know of a product or a chemical that might take the water stain off.
Unfortunately, you've got me there. Once raw wood gets a water stain in it, it is almost impossible to get anything to remove that stain, because the stain is deep into the wood grain itself. Short of covering it with a paint, I do not know of any way of getting a water stain out of raw wood. I've found houses 40 years old where I can use that as a an indicator, go down in the basement and look at a wall stud and say, well, here's where the water level used to be, but I can't tell you if it was this year or 40 years ago. So, yeah, it's almost impossible.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but thank you anyway. Thanks.
All right, very Bye. Good. Sorry we couldn't give a better answer. Let's go to Paris, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm calling about a garage. We had a garage with a concrete floor, and we turned it into a mud room or a recreational type room, and we'd like to put down some indoor-outdoor carpeting. Once in a while, that concrete kind of has a dampness, and I wonder if there's anything that we need to seal it before we put down the indoor-outdoor carpeting.
Well, unfortunately, the dampness probably is not coming up through the concrete. You can put a sealer on there to make sure that that doesn't happen. But generally what it is the concrete on a garage slab is not insulated. When we build a home, we put some type of insulating barrier down. A garage slab in contact with the soil will stay about 55 degrees. So when we get a really warm, humid day and that concrete slab is 55 degrees, you're going to get condensation. So no amount of sealer on the concrete is going to prevent the condensation. If the room is closed off, what I could recommend would be a dehumidifier to make sure that our humidity level does not get high enough to cause the condensation. But in general, concrete floors, unless you've got some way of keeping them warm, will do some type of sweating when we get, particularly when we get a big temperature swing, when it's been relatively cool outside and all of a sudden it gets really warm and humid, a rainy day when it turns 70 or 80, it's amazing how much more water will collect on that concrete floor.
Okay. Do you think we'd be all right to put down the indoor-outdoor carpeting and have a dehumidifier?
If you've got a dehumidifier, I think you're probably all right with the indoor-outdoor. It's one of those things where it's designed where it can get wet for short period of times. As long as you've got the dehumidifier to really keep any humidity down so we don't get mold and mildew in there.
Yes, that's what I want to avoid. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Piatt County is the next caller. Line 2.
Oh, good morning.
Yes,
good morning.
Hi. Mm-hmm.
I have a question. We redid an old barn that was sitting on a concrete block foundation, which the builder seemed to feel was quite adequate, although they did fix a few cracks and things in the concrete blocks. And then a couple more appeared, and a guy came out and said that as he fixed them, that our barn actually is on the highest part of the property, and it slopes away to a creek. But he said that we needed to put dirt as I can't think of the term around our concrete blocks to make more of a slope. Is that correct? The barn's been there for so long, and it's on the highest part of the property. And I was just wondering, why would I need to? Would I need to put dirt up against the concrete blocks again?
Well, it's always good with a structure to have some slope of the soil away from the foundation. You don't want to be bringing dirt all the way up to the siding, but uh-huh. to get some slope away. The soil that we have in our area has a relatively high clay content.
Uh-huh.
And clay, when it gets wet, will tend to expand, and when it dries, it shrinks. So if we end up with a gutter that overflows or a downspout that doesn't extend out and water sits next to the foundation, the soil next to the foundation wants to swell. Well, it doesn't swell enough to lift the foundation, but it does swell enough to try and move out from underneath the foundation. Then next time it dries out, it tends to shrink, and we can actually start moving or dropping the concrete foundation.
Uh-huh.
So the idea of the grading is to help reduce the amount of moisture which gets to the clay soil underneath the footing of the concrete blocks
mm-hmm.
so that we reduce the amount of movement. So it is not a bad idea to get some slope away from things. Yes, the footing has been there for a while. I'm a little concerned with a barn how deep the footing is. It
mm-hmm.
may be relatively shallow and maybe not as thick as what a residential construction would be. So keeping excess moisture away from it is not a bad idea.
Okay, so does someone come out and grade it? I mean, we have some landscaping around there, or do you just dump some topsoil there and level it?
Usually you try and get the grading so that, well, actually the local building codes, actually the national building code, states that the soil should be a minimum of 4 to 6 inches down on the block from the siding. So you want to see at least 4 to 6 inches of the concrete block. And from that point to a point 10 feet out in the yard is supposed to have another 6 to 8 inches of drop. So we should have roughly 12 or 14 inches from the bottom of the siding to a spot 10 feet out on the house. So, yes, the structure should be designed and intended to be on a hill to provide adequate slope.
Now, yeah, it is on a hill, actually.
Okay. So. All right. Well, what we end up with, particularly with a barn-type structure, which doesn't usually have a lot of overhang, we mm-hmm. get a lot of water runoff, creating a little trench or trough right next to the foundation. Mm-hmm. And we try and keep that drained. I've recommended in the past for different situations putting down a sheet of plastic and then putting down a decorative gravel that will help break up the water, and then the plastic will prevent it from soaking in until it gets a foot or two away from the foundation. There's several different landscaping solutions to draining water away, even on yards that are way too flat.
Mm-hmm.
So without actually seeing it, you know, if you're on a pretty good hill and you've got a reasonable slope and you've got gutters and or a drip edge that's far enough away from the foundation, you may not need to add more. But ideally, there should be some type of slope.
Okay. And would somebody advise us on that, or somebody who would come out, like somebody who grades?
Yeah, usually the landscaping company or somebody that does some lawn work can usually do that type of work.
Okay. Well, and you talked about the national standards. Is there somewhere I could read up on that?
Well, there's the BOCA codes, which is building codes.
Okay.
Usually they don't have it written on the internet. They like to charge you hundreds of dollars for the book.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your help and information.
All right. Thanks. Mm. You know, this is the kind of thing that we've talked about a lot, and I just have to believe that there are an awful lot of houses, mine would be on the list, where we don't have that kind of slope, and there's no way in the world we're ever going to get that kind of slope away from the foundation.
Well, it is difficult, and they have things from drained gravel bed solutions to actual tiling, all sorts of different things which can be done to try and correct those.
Yeah, okay. Our guest in this part of Focus, Scott Spies. He's an inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he's here on the program once a month, has been doing this for quite a while with us. So you can have a regular chance to call in and ask questions that have to do with home maintenance. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we do also have a email, so if you'd like to send your question that way, we would take it, and that is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Up next is Belgium, line one. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you, gentlemen. The gentleman in Atlanta that called about getting water stain out of lumber.
Yes.
There are ways to do it, and sometimes they're effective, sometimes they're not. It needs to be tested. Light woods are very difficult to do. Darker woods are easier. You can use a very weak solution of bleach. Sometimes will do it. A better and a little bit stronger situation is oxalic acid. You can find oxalic acid in various stores, like home improvement stores. It's used to bleach lumber.
Mm-hmm.
It should be made into like pretty heavy paste and put on there. Definitely use gloves and protection because it's not particularly kind to your body. But sometimes it will bleach out the stuff for you.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I know it's not easy to do, and there are some different remedies, and I've never found the surefire fix, so I was kind of shying away from it.
No, it's never surefire. It's always one of those things you got to play with and experiment. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And let's see. We have some other callers here. We'll just keep on to next, someone in Champaign, and line number two.
Hello.
Yeah.
We moved into a condominium 4 years ago. And had a termite inspection. We haven't done one since. Is there a recommended interval for doing that?
Well, that's a tough one. If things are dry, you probably don't have termites, but it's not a bad idea to have a pest control go over around it once in a while. Mm-hmm. I know once you've had termites, they like to do yearly inspections. If termites have not been found, I would probably recommend every 3 to 4 years.
Okay, so it's about time, in other words.
Most likely, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And usually the termites are looking for wet, damp wood. So if you've had a roof leak, or if you've had an area where we've had some water damage around a window, that you might want to bump that time frame up a little bit.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. You know, I had the experience myself at our house with some termites, and we got it taken care of, and we got into this cycle where we're, you know, we've committed to maintaining the service, and they do annual inspection, and they have the bait stations around the house. And I've decided to continue to keep doing that because I figure, well, it's cheaper than it would be if we have to go through the whole business all over again. But then I also, I guess it's kind of like insurance, you know, it's one of those things you pay the premiums hoping that it's that's actually never going to happen.
Well, the termites, they are nesting underground. The nest can be 10 or 15 feet below grade. It can be a quarter of a mile away from the home. Once they've been to your house, they have this little underground tunnel. They have this little freeway paved over to your house. Now, ideally, we've put in either a bait trap system where we bait the termites. We put in a chemical stick. It alters their body chemistry to where it's supposed to be taken back to the nest and kill off the colony. But if a neighboring colony gets too big and another queen moves into the old colony, they can come back. So once that path has been established between a nest and your home, yes, you should have a little bit more regular intervals as far as the inspection. Now, the older methods of termite control involved a chemical poisoning of the soil, putting in a chemical shield or barrier in the concrete blocks and in the soil around the house. They tend to last a little bit longer. The bait traps are very environmentally friendly, but they do need to be maintained.
Yeah. Okay. Well, other callers here. We'll go next to somebody who is calling on a cell phone on our line 3. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
I have a question about insulation. I bought an older home about a year ago. That's the first home I bought that was a masonry. It's a brick home built about, 1895. I'm considering doing some blown-in insulation in the walls, and I'm wondering if there's really a benefit to doing that. It's pretty massive walls. They're, I don't know, when you've got a brick wall, an air gap, and then you have some car siding, I guess, on that outer stud wall, and then there's a lath of plaster.
Okay, so you do actually have a stud wall. It's a masonry veneer home and not a solid masonry construction.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Yes, it will help to insulate that. The masonry is not an insulator. It's a good time delay. When the sun comes up and hits it and starts heating up the brick, it takes a while for the temperature to get through the brick, which means all night long when everything's all nice and cool and you get up in the morning and the sun comes up, the house stays nice and cool and you don't have much of an air conditioning load. But it does mean that around 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening when that heat from the early daylight, early sunlight starts working through there, it's amazing that you end up with a peak cooling load of an evening time. Back now, when the temperatures start dropping again, that's when your house is going to get the warmest, because that's when those the bricks have acted like a cooking stone. They've held that heat. That heat has worked its way through the brick and is now coming to the inside. I've known of houses, particularly limestone with a little bit thicker, where 10 o'clock at night, that house was hot. Now, most of the time you could open up a window, but that's when the air conditioner was running, was 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night.
Interesting. Okay.
So it's basically a time delay. It works really well as far as, you know, when the is really hot out right around noon, the house probably isn't all that warm because it's not getting through that brick. But later in the afternoon, that the home is going to get warm. So the insulation will help and reduce the amount of energy that it's going to take to cool the home or to heat the house, because masonry does transfer heat. It just slows it down a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me follow up on something. This home has some knob and tube still existing in it. There's been quite a bit updated, but I'm sure in the walls there's going to be some knob and tube in there. Now, I was considering this cellulose blow-in. It's basically, I guess, it would be a paper or newspaper that's been ground up.
Mm-hmm.
Is that safe to put in contact with that old knob and tube?
Okay, well, first of all, you want to make sure your knob and tube wiring is properly fused. Knob and tube wire in general is a smaller diameter wire than we use today, so you want to have no more than a 15-amp breaker or a fuse on it.
Okay.
It's usually a number 14 wire, whereas we're doing most of our wiring, at least in Champaign-Urbana, with a number 12 wire, which is rated for 20 amps. So if you've got older knob and tube wiring, I would definitely make sure that you have 15-amp breakers or 15-amp fuses on it. That is one of the requirements for it. Ideally, knob and tube does not like to be in direct contact with insulation just because we like to use the air to kind of cool it down. It's not necessarily a fire hazard. The cellulose is treated with a fire-rated material, so that, or fire-rated chemical, so that it's not a flammable source. And if the wire is properly fused, then it should never build up heat. So in my opinion, I would say it's not a big issue as long as we have ensured that the proper fusing is done. If we overfuse that wire, then yes, the wire starts getting warm. No, we can't get enough airflow to cool it because we got insulation around it. And yes, it could be a problem. So make sure that it is properly fused.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Very good. Next is Gilman, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We have a over 100-year-old farmhouse that we have, and an addition was put on not by a, it's a suburb, it's about 12 by 30. And when I had it landscaped, I had along the edge of the suburb facing south.
We're really having, you're kind of breaking up on it, so we're really having a hard time understanding you. I tell you what, and I think now we just lost the caller. Maybe you can try again. We'll see.
Okay.
Maybe we can get you in a slightly different place, or maybe we just get a better connection. Anyway, I'll tell you what. Why don't you try calling us back? In the meantime, let us go on to Champaign County. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. This is a question for a gardening person, but I think your father gave advice about using copper sulfate as a preventative to stop root growth in waistlines and stuff.
Yes.
I'd like for you to just say something generally about that. I have, my specific case is kind of unique. I have a berm in my basement, so the root growth is growing above the clean-out. So I was thinking I got one of these inflatable plugs, and I was going to trap the copper sulfate because it seems like it's a really a kind of a crapshot, excuse the pun, about when you just dump it in. And how you, I know you're not supposed to flush, but whether you really get it to the roots. I'll be sure to get it to the roots, but I'm just wondering, I don't want to kill anything. I don't know whether the copper sulfate stays there or does it travel up the roots at all. Or
It doesn't really wick very far up into the roots. It kind of shuts the roots down. It prevents them from wanting to take any moisture, so they tend to wither up and dry away. In that immediate vicinity, but no, it usually does not, unless you get it into the main trunk line of the plant or sprinkle it around topically around the plant. Usually the copper sulfate won't kill it. That's one of the reasons why we use it. It's relatively safe for the trees. It will deter the tree from wanting the roots to go towards the water lines. You know, obviously, any plant that's growing near your sewer line means that we have some leakage around the sewer line, some gaps, usually a clay tile type system. And all the plant is trying to do is find a water source. Well, if the copper sulfate is a deterrent to that, it does kill off the ends of the roots. Now, it's generally not going to affect the entire plant.
But how long should it stay and that kind of stuff? And the idea of not knowing whether it's going to actually have the right effect or get to the root of things?
Well, generally I recommend dumping about a pound of copper sulfate every 6 months or so.
Mm-hmm. Spring and fall, generally.
Yeah. And usually that is enough. The copper sulfate is heavy enough. It tends to stay in the line and dissolve slowly. And so that will usually give you a long-term protection. It just dissolves just enough to want to deter those roots. It's not something like you dump into sugar into water and stir it and it's gone. The copper sulfate will sit there in the granules and take a while to dissolve.
So my idea of trapping a solution of it, because I can trap the line for a while, may not really...
Yeah, it's not the liquid that we're worried about, that we are needing to keep in one place. It's more the granules themselves, and with time, the granules dissolve.
Okay, well, Thanks. I learned some things. Thanks.
Bye. All right. Thank you. The questions again, welcome 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. If you'd like to send a question by email, you can certainly do that. The address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. So this is just here again, this problem, the issue is plants, trees, pretty much, I guess, the roots want to grow in because the plant knows there's moisture there. If you have any kind of break or leakage in your – and I think the big problem here is with sewer connections.
Right. And right now, most of the newer homes these days are being built with PVC, which are a glued connection, and we have very little leakage into them for – around them, so we have very little roots getting into it. Most of the time when we're talking about root blockages, it's an older system, either a cast iron or a clay tile, where they came in 2-foot sections or 4-foot sections or 6-foot sections, and you kind of slid them together and usually put a little tar or mastic around there to seal these joints. And with time, the mastic or the sealant goes, and we get a little bit of water coming out around the joint. And sure enough, the tree's got those roots down there trying to get the nutrients out of the soil and finding this amazing water source that has all sorts of nutrients in there, and it will try its best to overtake that area. So putting the copper sulfate in there kills off the ends of the roots and prevents them from growing, so we don't have as much of a blockage in your tiles.
So if you have an older home and you don't have PVC, you have, say, you have clay tile, which probably there are a lot of people who do and around Champaign-Urbana, is that inevitable that at some place that you're going to get a break?
It's quite likely, yes, that at some point in time we're going to get something. Now, whether or not you've got something, hopefully the line is deep enough that we haven't got a lot of roots to it. But there are some areas, particularly with when you've got crawl spaces instead of basements, where the sewer line is not quite as deep, and so that the tree roots – and tree roots go amazingly deep. But usually we try and get it to where it's deep enough that most of the roots stay away from it. But yeah, I would have to say that if you've got one of the clay tile or the iron type pipes, that eventually you will end up with some blockages and have to call the guys to come out and clean it out.
All right. Mattoon, next. Line 4. Hello. Is that a caller there, Mattoon? Go ahead.
Oh, false alarm.
All right. Well, maybe that person might want to try again. We'll take as many calls as we can. We're getting around to midway of the show here. We're talking this morning with Scott Spies. He's with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on this program every month. It's always on a Monday, and we take questions on home maintenance. We're going to try again here with Mattoon, line 4. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes. Hi.
I have just a general question. I've observed that when I look at homes, even older ones, newer ones, a lot of newer ones, that when they're on the hill, sometimes they have a sump pump, and look to me like they got adequate drainage away from the house where you wouldn't need a sump pump. Why are they putting them in new homes?
It all depends on the clay layers and the soil layers. It's a lot easier to put one in while you're doing construction than it is to wait until you find out whether or not you need one. New home contractors don't want to have water problems. They don't want a reputation of having a house that has a water problem. It takes them little or no effort to dig a quick hole while the house is not there. You know, you've got a big open hole, you can dig a hole easily. Once you have a crawl space or a house built in a crawl space, it's almost impossible to get down there with your little foxhole shovel and no clearance and on your hands and knees trying to figure out where to put all this dirt and how to get it in and out. So it's one of those things where most new construction, they just put it in there because it's a lot easier. But even if you put a house on the top of a hill, with the geological soil composition we have around here, there could be a clay layer that is holding water. And so water from around the back of your garage soaks down, hits a clay layer, runs around, and all of a sudden finds this hole that you've dug your crawl space through. And so it starts dumping that water in there. So from a new construction standpoint, for the few $100 that it takes to do it, it's a whole lot easier to help guarantee we don't have a problem than it is to wait until we find out if we have a problem and then retrofit it.
Well, I have observed, well, one house in particular was up in Wisconsin on very sandy soil. They had a 9-foot, beautifully built basement and a sump pump in. It looked to me like if you did a good job of footer tile drainage on the floor and around the system, you wouldn't have to deal with a sump pump problem. And they got a sump pump problem for some reason. They get water in the basement with a sump pump.
Well, that my guess is, again, the top of a hill, interestingly enough, does have a lot of sand, which makes for very easy movement of water. So when it rains and the water soaks down, it wants to kind of fill that whole sand area. And depending on what the clay lens or the soil is underneath that sand is to where it's going to drain to. If we can fill up a lens, I've got an instance here in town that I've been monitoring for about 20 years now where every time it rains, a sump pump kicks on. And it's one of the higher places in Champaign-Urbana. When they dug this house, they managed to puncture this clay lens. And almost all the water for a block and a half goes to this one area. So it's very difficult to predict in advance where the soil is going to drain water. And once we start building houses and start changing drainage patterns, we have more issues.
Okay.
So I would have to say there's no good cut and dry way of determining whether we need a sump pump before we build it. So we put one in there, and it's amazing some of the houses that need a sump pump that you wouldn't think would, but definitely have water issues.
Right. This is our monthly show on home maintenance with Scott Spies. We'll take some more questions in a moment after we do this short break. This is Focus.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. The Alleluia Ringers are a well-traveled handbell choir from Concordia University in Wisconsin. Their spring tour will bring them to Decatur Monday night, and I'll talk with their director on the Monday edition of Live and Local. We'll also hear from Jody Prosser about a summer youth musical theater camp happening in Champaign during the month of June. Join me for Live and Local, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you here. In the second hour today, our guest is Mary Lovell. We'll talk about a new book that she's written that looks at the fascinating history of the Churchill family, the Churchills in Love and War, tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. The guest is Wendy Wolfe. She is an editor at Viking Penguin. We'll talk about a newly published biography of Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. And then also tomorrow at 11, for all of those people, and I'm sure there are a lot of people listening who are participate in the state university retirement system who have questions about the system and its whether or not it's solid and how things indeed may change for university retirees. We'll try to answer some of those questions tomorrow at the 11 o'clock show. We'll have two guests from the state university retirement system, William Mabe, he's the executive director, and Angie Lieb, she's the director of member services. You can get the schedule for the entire week by going to our website. You can also listen to past programs you might have missed. It's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, the guest is Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday, and this is your opportunity to ask questions about problems around the home. You got some kind of issue that needs to be solved, you give us a call, and Scott will do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you want to send an email, you can do that to will-talk@illinois.edu. We're just talking during the break there about water issues. It's like that we could do this forever, and we will always, always get calls from people who have water problems in their homes.
The water problems around here are one of our biggest issues. Champaign County has a reputation for a lot of wet basements and a lot of wet crawl spaces. A lot of it is attributed to a high water table, and we really don't have a high water table. What we have is a soil substrate which does not have particularly good drainage. So our surface water doesn't just soak right down and disappear. It tends to find all these little clay layers and all these little pockets and pools up. And I've been in older established neighborhoods that never had water problems, and somebody builds a new house someplace and all of a sudden two or three people start having to put in sump pumps. So once we start changing these subsoil drainage patterns, we can change how the water travels and which basements get it and which basements don't. So, yeah, unfortunately, still the best way is surface drainage. If we can get the water farther away from the house, the chances are it's going to stay away from the house. So I always like to recommend, particularly this time of year when the trees are throwing the little whirly gigs and all the extra seeds and such, get up there and clean those gutters, get that water out in the way, get the gutters extended out in the way. As many years as I've been doing home inspections, I still find houses with wet crawl spaces and wet basements from just general lack of maintenance around the exterior of the house. Mm-hmm. So I can't stress enough how we need to stay on the gutters and stay on the grading and make sure that water gets out in the way.
Well, is it still, though, do you see places where people have done what they can And for, you know, I keep going back to my house. For example, at our house, it's very difficult to get the kind of – we're just kind of in a low spot. It's very difficult to get the kind of slope. I think we've done about as good as we can. And, you know, the gutters seem to be doing okay and the downspouts are away from the house. But, you know, we still occasionally have problems. And I wonder, is it sometimes tricky to figure out where exactly – I mean, I know where the water's coming from. That's not so much an issue. It's the old thing about how it's probably coming off of our own roof, where the water's coming from, but it's somehow finding its way back to the house. And sometimes I wonder, well, it's just really tricky figuring out how exactly that, you know, what's the hydrology just around the house and how is it finding the way back?
Yeah, and that is a good trick. It's amazing. Most houses are fairly simple to fix, but every once in a while you'll get the one where no matter what you do, it wants to get just a little bit of water. Ideally, the footing tiles, the original basement footing tiles, should be taking water away. Mm-hmm. I do know that back in the 20s and a little earlier, they actually connected the downspouts to clay tiles that went around and connected to the footing tiles for drainage, which means if a downspout tile or footing tile starts to leak, all the water from your roof ends up around that leak and creates problems. Yeah. There is no cut and dry simple solution to all the problems, just because we don't know what's down underneath there. For the most part, we try and take care of it on the surface and external drainage. When we can't do anything from there, then we have to move our way in, generally in steps. Quick and easy, we put in a sump pump and try and keep the soil underneath the basement or in the crawl space down lower so the soil water level doesn't come up. When that doesn't work, then we may need to do baseboard drain systems or some type of perimeter tile inside the basement or inside the crawl space and run that to a pump. When that doesn't work, then we start worrying about getting reinforcement for the wall, waterproofing on the exterior. We may have to go on the outside of the house, dig down, put in some type of drainage system on the outside to help collect the water before it gets down to the bottom. Usually that's a lot more labor intensive and tears up all the landscaping around the yard, so that's usually one of the last things done. And you know, it's amazing how well that water travels through our soil. It you pour a glass on the ground and it tends to stay there for a while, then all of a sudden in an instant it disappears. So you never really know where it's going.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this hour. If you have questions about home maintenance, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Anything that's just of a seasonal nature or just on your mind you think it might be good to mention?
Well, we covered a lot of that. Seasonal being, yeah, it is time to clean the gutters. And, yes, the air conditioner, it is time to change the filter and check that. One of the things that tends to get overlooked is smoke alarms and carbon monoxide detectors. We do need to get the batteries changed in those. I know the fire department pushes a couple times a year to have that checked, but it's never a bad idea to go over there and hit the test button, see if it works. If it doesn't work, put a battery in it. Oftentimes, you'll see if it works, and it'll chirp for you, and you're going to have a smile on your face because it's functioning. And about 3 days later, you hear this little squeak over in the corner. It means that the battery has gone down. You've tested it. The battery was pretty low, and so you end up having to put a battery in it about 3 days later. It's like, wow, it just worked 2 days ago or 3 days ago. Well, it means the battery was about ready to go, and your testing was enough to drain it down.
Yeah,
but always a good idea to do that. It doesn't hurt this time of year with a weather change. Check the water heater. Make sure it's drafting properly. When the water heater is actually fired, whether or not you've used some hot water or whether you've turned up the temperature on it, check and make sure that we're getting good airflow. We're not getting combustion gases coming back and around it. A lot of the newer water heaters, we have direct vent units, which are nice. They've got a fan that draws it out. But I would say predominantly most of the water heaters we've got in this area are definitely a natural drawing or a convection type draft system, and we need to make sure that the squirrels haven't built a nest in there or some bird hasn't alighted on top of it and started putting some straw down the top of your flue. Make sure that water heater is venting so we don't get the carbon monoxide back in the house. Of course, this time of year is also animals nesting. I get more squirrel calls, more raccoon calls. I've got this noise in my attic. What is it? It's not a bad idea to take a walk around the outside of the house and look for any loose pieces of trim or holes that are chewed through some of the siding. Make sure that the rain cap / screening on the chimney hasn't been blown off in some of our good spring storms. just something to help make sure we don't get the rodents and animals, the undesirable creatures, into the house.
Yeah. All right. Champagne, here's a caller to talk with. Line number one.
Hey, hello there.
Hi.
Glad to hear you mention that Champagne's got kind of a funny water table. Remember that Champagne is the French word for a grassy swamp.
And it fits.
Which brings up some other things. Overgrown old landscape that is planted too close to the house. I like to have a stone dry area of about a meter and a half from the foundation out to where plantings begin. And the idea that sycamores, tree of heaven, and mulberry ought to be either condemned or damned or whatever you like to call them because of their problems. And also, especially in the case of sycamores, their year-round allergy problems.
Yeah, allergy problems and also, yeah, the amount of debris, everything from bark to twigs.
Everything from sycamores is a problem.
To extremely large leaves, to the little seed pods, which are just slightly smaller than golf balls and only take three of them to block a gutter.
You mentioned something else really important. No screws in your gutter work and also 3x4 instead of 2x3 downspouts.
There are different sizes of guttering, so if you have a problem area, they can put in what we'll call a commercial-grade guttering, which is a little bit larger gutter. So, yes, those are all valid points in trying to get things away. It's amazing when landscaping, particularly newer homes, the little bush that you buy, that it comes in a little plastic bag and you carry over there and you plant it next to the house, and all of a sudden it goes to 3 foot square, except you only plant it at a foot and a half away from the house. So what it tries to do is it wants to rub up against the siding and hold moisture against the siding. So when doing the planting, particularly on new construction or even just changing out shrubbery next to old homes, think of what size that plant's going to be fully grown, not what it is right now when you plant it. Yes, it may look a little strange, be out as far as it is the first couple of years, but once it grows and fills out, then it'll look proper again.
Yeah, that's the problem. Getting there for any time you're going to put something in that's the perennial, that's going to stay there. Getting proper spacing when they're little, if you do that, you think that there's something wrong with that. But yes, and what you have to do is try to get in your mind what size that plant is going to be when it does all the growing it's going to do.
And of course, when they're young, the plants grow the fastest. So it's only going to be a couple years before it actually gets to where it fills things out.
Okay. Another Champagne caller. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about sump pumps. I heard you guys talking about that last month and a little bit more today about water in the basement. I've had trouble with water freezing in the line, the ejection line of the sump pump, and I've had that happen both inside of the house and outside of the house, and I'm wondering what I can do to prevent that so that the water will in fact flow away from the sump pump.
Well, ideally the line, I don't know where you're trying to drain it to. You want to run it as much as you can below grade. It should have a downhill slope so it wants to drain so we don't actually hold water in the pipe. Most houses, now obviously we don't have a blanket answer for everything in Champaign area or our listening area, but most houses, when it's freezing rain or freezing cold outside, freezing temperatures, we don't have as much water to be pumped out. So a lot of people don't have a problem with freezing. If you've got a home or a situation where we do have water pretty much year-round, whether it's frozen outside or not, we need to start looking for where can we put it that's not a surface drain. Is there a storm sewer that we can run it to? Can we put in a drained gravel bed out in a way that we can dump it to? Something where we can keep the discharge pipe for the sump pump 8 or 10 inches below grade where it stays warm enough we don't end up with that freezing problem. So I can't say there's an easy answer. I don't recommend heat tapes. I don't recommend going out there with a torch and melting the lines. If it's got a downward slope, it should help drain. However, repeated usage when it's quite cold out, the ice can still build up. Say if you've got one that you're relying on it regularly, even when we have that really cold temperature, we may need to start thinking, okay, where can we put it where we can keep that line warmer by burying it in the soil?
I have a suspicion that there's a low point in it that tends to hold water.
Mm-hmm. Outside?
Actually, inside, but it's near a basement window where
you should not have any. You should never freeze a line inside the house, because we should not ever have freezing temperatures inside the house. So if you're freezing it, it's usually an ice plug outside somewhere, whether or not you have a low spot or something. I've seen people put a T in the line where they end up with a 2 or 3 foot standpipe, so if it freezes at the end, that the water can bubble straight up. But that, again, just tells you that, hey, I've got a plug somewhere, because eventually that's going to freeze as well. The only surefire way when you've got something like that is to get that line warm enough by getting it, like say, at least 8 to 10 inches down underground to run it to your discharge point.
Is it possible for the line to freeze inside of a finished wall?
Shouldn't be, because the line itself should be warm, unless you have cold air blowing directly on it, and we've got a spot on there that is forming just a little bit of ice every time it runs and creates an ice plug. Generally speaking, no, you're not going to get your freezing or your plug in the line inside the house. Usually it's got to be on the outside. If you've got it inside the house, we need to worry about sealing up the protrusions through the wall and get some insulation around it, things like that. But the water coming out of the sump pump is effectively 55 degrees ground temperature. The house itself is relatively warm, so there should be no way that we're going to freeze anything or hold a pipe cold enough to freeze until it gets, in general, several feet from the house.
Yeah. Okay, once the line is outside of the house, should it be pointed dramatically downward if it exits the house a foot above the...
Yeah, for what you're doing, you're going to want to have it pointing pretty much down, yes, because you're going to want it to drain quickly so we don't hold that water for a long enough period of time for it to actually freeze solid.
Okay.
I suppose in extreme cases, if we have something like that, they do make water tank heaters for like horses and dogs and things like that, and we could put that in a sump pump so your sump pump water is warm, so at least when it goes out, it has a less chance of freezing. It tends to want to melt things, but I sure wouldn't want to have to do that on a regular basis, because it would be awful expensive to operate.
Yes, to operate a heater. Uh-huh. Okay.
All right.
Okay. Well, that gives me some ideas. Thank you very much.
Very good. And it is, we talked about this before, it is allowed to connect your sump pump to the storm sewer, but not to the sanitary sewer.
In certain cases, you're not supposed to be connected to the storm sewer or the sanitary sewer at all, because the sanitary sewer is not sized large enough for pumped systems, whereas the storm sewer is usually a little bit larger because it's designed to take sudden influx of water large quantities at a time because it rains everywhere at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Most places you can connect up into the sewer line. Some areas say, no, we can't connect directly to it. But if you make a case where, hey, I've got this, the basement floods on a regular basis, we got freezing, such as our last caller, you can get variances and get somebody to say, okay, yeah, you can go ahead and connect to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what the basic idea is that really what you're supposed to do is to take it and run it out on the surface, and you want to make sure that, again, that gets far away from the house, because you don't want it to come right around back and go back into the house. But the idea is that it's supposed to be drained out on the surface.
Ideally, yes. Now, a lot of the new subdivisions are connecting them up direct to storm sewers, and they are sizing the storm sewers for that type of load. You have to remember that gravity feeding a drain pipe does not fill it anywhere near as fast as pumping water to a drain pipe. You can take an inch and a half pipe from a sump pump and move a whole lot more water than if you were to just pour water down through it and let it gravity drain. So what happens is they size the storm system for gravity drain systems, and then all of a sudden you get 4 or 5 sump pumps in there, and 4 or 5 inch and a half sump pumps will fill an 8-inch line pretty darn quick. where if we can put it to the surface and let it flow and give it a kind of a time delay, that same pipe will never fill up with the same quantity of water because it runs through there much slower instead of being pumped to it.
Okay. If someone wants to call real quickly, we can, I'm sure, get in maybe one or two more callers. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of these days, it's actually going to get warm and stay warm, and it might actually stop raining. So people are going to be probably thinking about painting. Anything in general you want to say about painting?
Well, that's a good point, David. Thanks for bringing that up. If you've got some peeling paint where it has come down to bare wood, I highly recommend a really light sand, a touch sanding, to make sure we get rid of the oxidized wood almost immediately before painting. In other words, don't do large areas. Don't do the entire wall of the house on the exterior or something and then go back and try painting it. Do some sanding, put a primer on it, then go do some more sanding and prime it. Once you've got it all primed and sealed, then the paint will stick a lot better once it's been sanded.
Okay. One more caller here, I think. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'd had a similar problem with my sump pump outlet hose freezing. It had been a flexible hose, and sure enough, it would often freeze, at least if it was in contact with the ground. But the solution I found was to replace the stiff-walled hose with one that could collapse completely. So I got actually a much thinner walled hose and attached it to the hose clamp on the outside of the house. And where the old one would freeze with solid plugs of ice, and I'd be going out there with, you know, hot tea kettles trying to thaw it until I could, you know, which was a pain. This one, it freezes, but it's so thin that the pressure of the water can easily inflate it. And since I did that several years ago, I've had no more trouble with the thing freezing up in springtime.
Okay, I'm not sure I'm familiar with a pipe of that. With those type of qualities?
It was just, I'd got it at a local hardware store. It's just, it's a thin blue plastic material. I don't know the name of it, but it was just a run-of-the-mill thing. It was the same diameter as the 1.5-inch.
I think I know what you're referring to. Usually they use it for temporary drains for like swimming pools and stuff. When you back flush your swimming pool, you can buy this stuff in like a 40 or 50 foot roll and hook it up there. I think I know what you're talking about. It's relatively lightweight. It's not particularly durable. It's something you'd have to replace every couple of years. It doesn't do too well with UV, with sunlight. So it's something you'd have to do some maintenance on and make sure you keep it in good condition because it'll
That's
tend
good
to leak.
To know. In my case, it's in a fairly shady spot, which may mean why I haven't had to worry about it. But I'll pay attention to that. But at least it's kept it from freezing.
That's an interesting idea. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, and thank to all the people who called. We're going to have to leave it there for this time around. But next month, Scott will be back. We'll do it again. It's almost on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. Thank you very much,
David. Thank you for letting me come.